welcome to University Matters on Campus FM. I'm Patricia Camilleri. In this series, I will be talking to academic staff about their research, their international networks, their aims and plans for the future. I shall also be hearing from staff and students about the many events that take place here at the University of Malta. This is the programme that keeps you informed about what's happening on campus. I'm very happy to have with me in the studio today Professor Stephen C. Kaleya. Professor Kaleya is Director and International Relations Associate Professor at the Mediterranean Academy of Diplomatic Studies here at the University of Malta. He's also Rector's Delegate for International Relations. He's also an advisor to the Minister of Foreign Affairs in Malta with the status of Ambassador. Professor Kaleya has been project manager since 1996 of the Euro-Mediterranean Information and Training Seminars for Diplomats that's funded by the European Union. And this is an official confidence-building mechanism of the Euro-Mediterranean Partnership. He's Mediterranean editor of the journal Mediterranean Politics, published by Frank Cass, and editor of the journal Global Networks, published by Blackwell. He's visiting professor at the Centre for European Integration Studies, the University of Bonn, and a member of the Euro-Mediterranean Study Commission. As a guest analyst, he's participated in numerous interviews, including regular contributions to the BBC World Service. His publications include Navigating Regional Dynamics in the Post-Cold War World, Patterns of Relations in the Mediterranean Area. More recently, in 2005, Evaluating Euro-Mediterranean Relations. And his latest publication, which is going to be the subject of today's chat, is entitled Security Challenges in the Euro-Med Area in the 21st Century. Certainly an extremely topical subject. Thank you for being with us, Professor Kaleya.
Thank you for this invitation.
Looking at a description of your new publication, one can see that there are some overarching themes and that the book is sort of divided into various areas, various subjects. Perhaps you could just give us a bit of an overview of what the book deals with.
Yes, absolutely. Firstly, again, thank you for this opportunity to share with everyone this new publication, which is just being released by Routledge Publications in the United Kingdom. The theme of the book is precisely correlating with the title of the book, Security Challenges in the Mediterranean. What the book does is really focus on three specific frameworks of analysis. The first is providing an overview of the security situation that exists at this moment in the Mediterranean. The second is looking at, as we all know, the Mediterranean has been experiencing a tremendous fundamental sea change, as we like to put it, a historical revolutionary development, which is resulting in a complete change in the outlook of all foreign policies of the countries in the region. So the book examines what pattern is starting to emerge after what we've been referring to as something like the Arab Spring. The third component of the book is looking at then what we're able to identify already, or perhaps not identify enough, of the reaction by the international community to the changes that have been taking place in our part of the world, the Mediterranean. So in essence, one way of putting it is you have a holistic review of the geostrategic situation in our Mediterranean.
What is, of course, so fascinating, before we sort of go into the latest happenings, so fascinating about the Mediterranean, you know, what we talk about, the Mediterranean basin, but the differences between parts of the Mediterranean basin and not only north and south, which is a very obvious divide, but also the divisions within the two rims, I think is an important thing to sort of outline and mention.
You are absolutely correct. In fact, we refer to what we define as the Mediterranean, but in actual fact, there are many Mediterraneans. And what this book does is zoom in to the sub-regions of our Mediterranean to identify specificities that exist in the different geographical locations that form part of the sea basin. In essence, you have a southern European catchment of countries, if I could put it like that, including, of course, Malta. You also have North Africa, the so-called Maghreb, where you have countries from Morocco to Libya, figuring in that catchment of the Mediterranean. And then you have the so-called Mashrik, or the Levant, the Eastern Mediterranean, again, along the southern shore. So here we're talking about Egypt, extending right up to Syria. What are we able to identify when it comes to the specific geostrategic direction of the different countries? What are the specificities? Because even there, the fact that you have a sub-regional zoom of the analysis can be somewhat misleading if you're not precise when it comes to the specificities of each of the countries. For example, if we look at the Maghreb, we have a country like Algeria or a country like Libya, which are very fortunate to have incredible natural resources, be it them oil or gas, which results in the country having a completely different perspective, at least to the extent that one talks about potential, in comparison to the likes of, for instance, Morocco, or for that matter, even Tunisia. Libya, we're talking about 6 million people. Tunisia, we're talking about 10 million people. If we shift to other countries such as Egypt, we're talking about 85 million people. So again, the extent to which one talks about the Mediterranean or even the southern shore of the Mediterranean can be misunderstood if not carefully considered. And the book does provide a country-by-country snapshot, up-to-date snapshot, of the political, economic, and socio-cultural trends that have been taking place over the last decade. That, I think, is a crucial first step before one then plunges into the geopolitical and geoeconomic realities of the foreign policy interaction that exists, whether it is between the countries of a specific subgroup, so the North African countries or the Middle Eastern countries, or if even further complicated, if one looks, for example, if a north-south dynamic of the relationships that, for instance, that we like to refer to as the Euro-Mediterranean relations. Here we're talking about, of course, EU member states with non-EU Mediterranean countries. I think it is absolutely crucial, and the book is very much meant to be not only an academic exercise, of course that's what it is first and foremost, but is also meant to be an eye-opener for everyone, to the extent that with a little bit of an effort, one can certainly be able to understand the statistics that are provided from the outset in the introductory part of this book.
Certainly a book like this will surely help people avoid the generalizations that one sometimes comes across in conversation. This is a problem, really.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we in the Mediterranean are either blessed or cursed to be referred to practically by everyone. And we're done. This happens because of the diversity, but also because of the importance of the Mediterranean. Of course, we know the Mediterranean was always important from a historical perspective, but the Mediterranean remains a very crucial strategic waterway when it comes to global commerce, even in the 21st century. So one has to guard against the generalizations. You're absolutely correct. Simplifications, cliches. You know, it's one thing to refer, and here's where the security dynamic now starts to kick in, to refer to the Arab-Israeli conflict, or to refer to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, or to refer to the Cypriot conflict, or to refer to the Sahara conflict. These references seem to flow off the tip of one's tongue because of the limelight that they've managed to capture over decades now. But unless one is constantly observing the specificities of the countries concerned and of the peoples concerned, in the case of the Palestinians, because they don't have their own country up to now, I would argue it's not doing justice to the different cases.
The expression Arab Spring is one of those buzzwords as well, which people have caught on to. The media certainly latched onto it immediately. But, of course, again, a generalization. Yes. Perhaps you could go into a little bit, obviously, with the short time we have at our disposal, say, Tunisia, where it seems to have sort of started.
2 years ago, international relations in the Mediterranean started to change completely. The reference to the Arab Spring, you're absolutely correct, is the most often used terminology in international relations. But to be more precise, what we're talking about is a profound transformation of the governance of the countries across the southern shore of the Mediterranean from whatever existed in recent decades. It, of course, was triggered by upheaval, revolution that took place in Tunisia at the start of 2011. And very quickly, we saw what sometimes we like to refer to as a domino effect of similar types of developments, indigenous developments. Very important to highlight this point. It was the peoples of the specific countries that decided they were no longer prepared to accommodate the different systems of governance that they had. We saw a similar upheaval then in Egypt in February 2011. And then, of course, we saw as well from March onwards in Libya for over 6 months a civil war unfolding. The outcome of this sent not only a major development of profound change within these countries, but sent a clear signal across the Mediterranean, especially the southern shore of the Mediterranean, again, the Arab world, that the regimes that had dominated the governance of these different countries was no longer something that could be taken for granted. And very quickly, we had the departure of the Tunisian president, Ben Ali, followed by the disposal of the Egyptian regime, led by Hosni Mubarak. And then also we had, of course, as we know, the bloody civil war in Libya, which led to the end of 4 decades of a regime led by Muammar Gaddafi. What are the consequences of this? Well, first and foremost, you have incredible transition taking place, which obviously one would hope is going to go in a specific direction of what we like to refer to as democracy. But let's be a bit more precise, a system of governance where the people have a voice. And then in addition to that, obviously also a functioning economy where the distribution of wealth is not among the few, among the elite, but is distributed much more widely across society. But this is not a foregone conclusion. And the book highlights this point emphatically, that it's one thing to desire a specific direction when it comes to international relations, but of course it is much more important to appreciate the nature of the challenge that these countries are actually experiencing, and then over and above that, see how one can address the specific challenges by introducing within the countries themselves, first and foremost, because it is up to the countries to take the decisions, a specific plan of action mapping out a direction, whether it is the introduction of a constitution, whether it is mapping out a time frame of holding specific elections, whether it is clarifying the extent to which all of civil society will be able to participate in this new era and this new chapter of the country's destinies. Followed up by also a comprehensive international program to consolidate what the countries would like to do. The book provides an eye-opener into the multifaceted and plethora of challenges that these countries are facing. It does that not to discourage or on a pessimistic wavelength, but for everyone to appreciate the nature of the challenge. And most importantly, at least this is what I advocate in the book, is to, as far as is possible, introduce specific mechanisms that will take advantage of this historic moment we are experiencing. To my mind, it would be unacceptable. Unacceptable for all of us who champion the Mediterranean when it comes to peace and security, but secondly, also unacceptable for the future generation within these countries to have this window of opportunity and then not introduce mechanisms that allow these people to have a better outlook from anything that they've been experiencing throughout their lifetime.
the economy of these countries. You mentioned at the beginning that they have diverse economies. How much does the economy, how much influence does it have on then the development of the countries after the, for want of a better word, revolution?
Politics and economics are two sides of the same coin. Of course, this is maybe interpreted as a cliche, but it's not. First and foremost, when you're going through these revolutionary transitions, it's absolutely crucial that there are clear signals of stability starting to emerge. It is absolutely to be accepted that and expected that one will sometimes take two steps forward and one step back, or maybe even two steps back occasionally, but there must be a clear commitment emerging that the peoples of the country are committed to the cause of introducing a stable system of governance, a system of governance which is based on the rule of law. This is sine qua non to being able to introduce any possible way forward when it then comes to the economic side of the coin. Unless you have political stability, the fundamentals of a functioning economy will not be allowed to take place. What we see up to now is a very sketchy schema emerging. Yes, elections have been held. Yes, some crucial decisions have taken place. But in actual fact, one has to specify about which country you're referring to. Tunisia has had the most positive track record over the last 2 years. Why? Because they've held elections, they've respected the outcome, they are drafting a constitution, a very healthy debate, plenty of differences of opinion being aired, and obviously also you have a people that are much more advanced when it comes to their educational track record. This is perhaps one of the positive outcomes despite the system of government that which they had previously, which allows them to be able to move forward in a much more dynamic way than other countries have so far been able to do. But in reality, the fact that you've had this fundamental sea change taking place, this revolution by definition taking place, is obviously also an element of concern when it comes to, for instance, attracting foreign direct investment. Foreign direct investment is the oil that wheels the machinery of the international political economy. Unless the countries concerned are able to attract a specific amount of investment, it's quite clear that they will not be able to move beyond the cyclical nature of development which they were experiencing up until now. The second crucial point here is as well the extent to which they're able to sustain those sectors of the economy which were the major foreign exchange earners up until now. Of course, we in the Mediterranean all know that one of those sectors is tourism. We are all blessed by wonderful sunshine, fantastic weather, great food, you name it. And as a result, our economies have been able to thrive as a result of dynamic tourist related or directly or indirectly components of the economy. What has happened in places like Tunisia and Egypt, which were thriving in a tourist from a tourist perspective, is paradoxically the opposite since the revolutions. First and foremost, there were these travel advisories which were indicating that it is not safe to go to these countries, and one understands that. But interestingly enough is that once the revolutions took place, you don't have an opposite type of dynamic kicking in where the foreign offices of the respective countries announce that it is now safe to go to these countries. And quite often, it's once bitten, twice shy. There's a tendency for people at large to shy away from going to countries that perhaps were in the news, even if it was 1 year ago or 2 years ago, because there's a tendency to have this perception of instability. Unless the likes of Tunisia, Libya at some point, and of course Libya is a completely different case study because there the extent to which we've been able to see some traction towards stability has not taken place. We more or less have a continuation to a certain extent of the civil war which took place as a result of the diversity of the tribal system that they have there and also the distinction between the east and the western parts of the country, that these countries will not be able to move ahead economically, which is crucial if a different outlook, a positive outlook, is to start emerging sooner rather than later.
In a way, a country like Libya is at an advantage because they have oil revenues, which is what they've been living on these last 40 years, really. They have great potential for tourism, but they can actually do without it for the moment.
Yes.
Until they settle things. Other countries along the northern littoral are not so fortunate, are they?
Yes, no, you're absolutely correct, but it all always comes down to the same thing, the extent to which a system of governance is providing you with enough stability that you can take advantage of whatever it is that you happen to have at your disposal, whether it's a human resource, a natural resource, or a manufactured resource. In the case of Libya, this is not the case up to now. What you have is a completely chaotic situation on the ground. And even something like the revenues that are being earned as a result of the oil exports, and they are extremely high, to the tune of $50 billion a year, it begs the question as to the extent to which these revenues are being managed in a specific way. The indicators during the previous historic moment was that the authoritarian system of governance would, of course, control completely the revenues, and then what they did with them, there was a big question mark. Today, interestingly enough, there is another question mark. We still have a question mark. According to what we know, while oil production has returned to the pre-revolution period of approximately 1.5 million barrels a day, it is still a question as to where these revenues are going. And some reports refer to as high as 40% of the revenue being unaccounted for. So one again has to appreciate the extent to which we have a lack of not only accountability and transparency, but a direction. Unless a country can control its coffers, it will not be able to move ahead in a stable and prosperous manner, regardless of what type of wealth they have at their disposal. At least this is something that I believe is the case.
I mentioned the external pressures or the external stakeholders, shall we say, from NATO, the United States, the European Union. How are they actually looking at the situation, especially with regard to security at the moment? Because it's one thing encouraging a change in regime or democratization in theory, but it's another one coping with the results of that.
Well, this is one I believe the major inspiration behind the book was, of course, the historical transformation, but then also the extent to which the international community was reacting one way or the other to this unbelievable chain of events. What we've seen in the last 2 years is something completely different from what occurred in somewhat similar historic moments that have taken place in contemporary international relations. Obviously, every historic moment is different, but if one refers to, for example, the end of the Cold War, now over 20 years ago, we saw an unbelievable collective reaction and approach and proactiveness to looking at Eastern Europe completely differently from what existed between the Second World War and the end of the Cold War. One does not automatically expect that you'll see something on the same scale, because every case is different, but to have an historical moment unfolding in a geostrategic waterway like that of the Mediterranean, and then see what I would refer to and the book describes as an indifferent or ambivalent policy reaction, to my mind, is completely unacceptable. It's unacceptable not only to someone like Malta, which has, of course, always had the Mediterranean at the heart of its foreign policy making since independence in 1964, but I would argue should be unacceptable also to those actors that are embedded in the international relations of the Mediterranean, the proximate organizations that are located, for example, the European Union, proximate to the Mediterranean. But even I would go beyond that. You will not have stability anywhere when it comes to international commerce if you don't have stability in the Mediterranean. And what we've seen up to now is a very ad hoc, knee-jerk reaction to the developments taking place. The book focuses primarily on the European Union. It does that for two reasons. One is because I've had the privilege of working in EU circles dealing with the Mediterranean for over 20 years. So one can imagine that along come these revolutions, what one may be thinking as a result of what the EU's policy rethink will consist of. Well, I can tell you that up to now we've had very little rethinking of any kind. What we've had is a review, a continuous review, which has been quite, again, I would argue, unbelievable. Unbelievable not because someone is naive to think that the EU is going to solve the problems of the countries concerned. Far from it. International relations is all about identifying your interests. It is in the EU's interest to have stability in the Mediterranean. This is something that we all know, but unfortunately we're not prepared, it seems, to take the necessary action to introduce policies to take advantage of that moment. And then one can go through a long list, essentially, to capture the imagination of all those that are listening, something similar to a Marshall Plan type of reaction, whereby, listening carefully to what the countries request, one addresses the political necessities, the economic necessities, the educational necessities of the different countries, and starts introducing a policy platform that will allow the countries to move forward. I am, to be blunt, which is, I think, very important to do, flabbergasted by the lack of creative thinking, strategic thinking that has emerged up to now. And ultimately, I think all of us who have been looking at the Mediterranean and learning about the Mediterranean and living in the Mediterranean, and I think this is the key message of the book, should have a sense of responsibility given this historic moment to voice clearly this important message. Everywhere I go and everyone we come into contact with through the University of Malta, the Mediterranean Academy of Diplomatic Studies, highlights this crucial point. Please, whether it's from the Mediterranean to voice our concerns or when we travel beyond the Mediterranean, is to help us understand and appreciate the reality of the situation on the ground. One should not take for granted that everyone is always constantly looking at the Mediterranean.
Well, thank you very, very much, Professor Stephen Kalea, for coming to talk to us today about your new book, Security Challenges in the Euro-Med Area in the 21st Century. Thank you so much. Thank you for being with us on University Matters. You can listen to any of the previous interviews in this series on the Campus FM website. I hope you'll join us again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.